Now, I don't know about you, but I deal with impulse control when it comes to hobbies, when it comes to things that I'm passionate about or that I'm interested in. I picked up golfing a few years back, and sound guys, I don't know if you can hear it or not, but there's a fuzz that's coming through pretty hot with my mic. But anyways, I picked up golfing a few years back, and I really got into it. I had never golfed before. Golfing wasn't something that we did growing up with my dad or with my mom. It wasn't, so I was terrible at it. But I picked it up, and I was excited about it. Every chance that I got, I would go to the driving range. I'd go with friends to the golf course. I even took a couple lessons. I don't know if that actually helped that much, but I did anyways. And unfortunately, a while of playing golf, I found out an unfortunate truth. And that was, as much as I loved golf, golf did not love me. The feeling was not reciprocal. And so after falling into a black hole of internet research, trying to figure out what the best clubs were to buy, because that must have been the problem, right? The problem wasn't me. The problem wasn't that I was a bad golfer. I just needed better clubs. And so I was researching and checking out everything, and I proudly came to Mel very enthusiastically, and I was like, okay, this is the solution to all of our golfing problems. And she's like, your golfing problems? I was like, oh, solution to all of my golfing problems, and I just need $2,000 clubs. And then everything will be better. At which point, Mel was like, Joe, slow your roll. It's not happening. And so I went back to the internet black hole of research, and I did some more research and study, and I found that you can get a very good beginner set of clubs at a much more affordable price, and that's what I've got now. And I was so excited when I got these new clubs. They're Adams clubs, for anyone who's interested in getting into golf, would recommend. But I was so excited, I went out to the course for the first time, and I was ready to see the difference in my game that these clubs made. I was ready for it. And I learned a very important truth that day. The problem was not the clubs. The problem was not the clubs. The problem had something to do with the player. Sometimes I can get a little bit carried away. But speaking of getting carried away, I didn't actually come here to talk to you about golfing. I came here to talk to you about the Sermon on the Mount. And as we continue our series, Summer on the Mount, I want to encourage you once again to allow the Sermon on the Mount to capture your imagination over and over again until it reshapes your desires and transforms your life. And it's at precisely this point in Jesus' sermon that people are starting to worry a little bit. It's at precisely the point that we're going to be picking up today where people are thinking that Jesus is getting a little bit carried away. First, he started with the Beatitudes. He started by saying, look, the kingdom of heaven is open to anyone. Anyone is welcome into the kingdom of heaven. To the people that religion and society had neglected and left behind. That is who the kingdom of heaven for. It wasn't just for white suburban families with two-car garages. It isn't just for people who are particularly good or morally upright. And so they were still trying to wrap their minds around this, and then Jesus carries on. And he carries on, he drops another truth bomb, and he says, it is precisely these people, it's precisely those little people that have been overlooked and neglected, these are the ones that make the world work. These are the ones who are supposed to be my representatives. These are the salt and the light. These are the ones who preserve the earth, that flavor the earth, that make life worth living. These are the ones that make life work. The formerly neglected are now accepted in the kingdom of heaven. And while this was certainly good news to a lot of people, this was good news to most of Jesus' crowd. Most of Jesus' crowd, if you remember, were those people, the people that had been neglected and left behind. But there was definitely some people who were getting a little bit nervous. Jesus, where are you going here? You know what they were probably thinking? They were probably thinking this, Jesus, slow your roll. Take it easy. Calm down. And how do I know that? Because all moral people have this internal tension. And the moment that they feel like someone is about to say that the rules don't matter, or that you can live however you want, or that as soon as there's a little bit of grace involved, that it stretches. And it was stretching, and it was making them uncomfortable. And if Jesus went any further, they were afraid it was just going to snap. So what is Jesus going to say to them? How far is he going to take this? Well, Jesus is the great teacher, and he knew their hearts in that moment. And so this is what he says next in Matthew 5:17. He says, "Don't misunderstand why I've come." He's like, "I know what you're thinking. Don't misunderstand why I've come. I did not come to abolish the law of Moses or the writing of the prophets. No, I came to accomplish their purpose." He says, "Look, I know what you're thinking. I'm not throwing the baby out with the bathwater here. The law isn't going anywhere. I've come to accomplish their purposes." Or many translations say, "I've come to fulfill the law." And so what does Jesus mean when he says he came to fulfill the law? It means that Jesus came to show us a better way to be human. This means that love is not a tension with the law. It's not love versus the law, but they're actually properly understood together. Properly understood, the law is a delight. I mean that seriously. If you read Psalm 1, it talks about how the law of the Lord is a delight. But here is the thing. They had the same problem that we still have today. For most people, the law is not a delight. The law is not a delight. It is a constant reminder that you are not good enough. It's a constant reminder of your failings. It's a constant reminder of your faults. And it's at this point that Jesus tells them that they completely misunderstood the whole point of the law. And we're going to pick up again in verse 20. He says this. He says, "But I warn you, unless your righteousness is better than the righteousness of the teachers of the religious law and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." It's a mic drop moment right there. And to understand why that's such a bold statement, we have to have a little bit of understanding on who these two groups of people are. First of all, we have the teachers of the religious law, or the scribes, as they were often called. And these people studied the law for a living. This was kind of their thing. And so if you wanted to know what the law said about anything, you could go and you could ask a scribe, and they would tell you what the law said. They could tell it, repeat it to you backwards and forward. They knew it inside and out, and they could expound on the law and all of their various interpretations of it. And Jesus is saying, we have to be more righteous than those guys? But that's not all. He keeps going. He talks about the Pharisees. Who are these Pharisees? Well, the Pharisees were a grassroots religious sect of Judaism that believed the only way to see the kingdom of heaven come was through strict adherence to the law. And so they took following the law extremely seriously. In fact, in order to not break any laws, they built laws around the laws. But they found that itself was still insufficient. And so they built a set of laws around those laws. These guys' laws had laws had laws. And Jesus is saying, you've got to be more righteous than those guys. See, Jesus all of a sudden goes from radical inclusivity, hey, everybody's welcome, to radical accountability. The key to what Jesus is saying is the meaning of the term righteousness. And righteousness is that Greek word I mentioned a couple weeks ago, diakosune. And diakosune speaks not just of your actions, not just how you behave. It speaks of the kind of person that you are on the inside, who you are in your inner being. And so Jesus' point is this. Morality is simply not good enough. You cannot legislate morality into the hearts of people. A different type of diakosune, a different type of righteousness is needed. Love is the higher law. Jesus expounds and explains this by giving us six examples of kingdom righteousness. And he follows this pattern of saying, "You have heard it said, but I say." You have heard it said, but I say. And he starts right at the heart, right at the root problem of almost all law breaking He starts with the depth of anger. And so we're gonna read the first of these "you have heard it said" statements. You have heard that your ancestors were told, you must not murder. If you commit murder, you are subject to judgment. But I say, if you are even angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. If you call someone an idiot, you are in danger of being brought before the court. And if you curse someone, you are in danger of the fires of hell. That's pretty intense. That's a long way from just don't murder somebody. You know, most people read don't murder, and they're like, okay, I think I can do that. And even still, we don't always keep that one. And Jesus says, no. If you're willfully angry at someone, you've broke the law. Now, to be clear what Jesus is not saying, he is not saying that anger and murder are the same thing. He's not saying that they're equally as bad. What he is saying is that not murdering someone doesn't make you a good person. That is still a very low bar. Anger and contempt must be pulled out at the root. See, we have no idea how deep-rooted your anger is until something draws it out. You know, we often feel like we've got a pretty good handle on things until we come up to a situation where our true inner self is exposed. Since we're talking about anger, I feel like golf is another great transition point right here. I took my clubs out of storage after finding out that the clubs weren't the problem. We took a break. Okay, it wasn't them; it was me. We just needed a 2-year break to cool off and think things through. But anyways, pulled the clubs out and have been golfing a little bit, and it's been fun to get back at the game. And I thought I would take my kids golfing because they always want to do things with me, and they really want to go golfing with me. And so I take them golfing, and we're at one of the holes just at the Ladysmith golf course here, and I'm getting ready. You know, I'm to tee off, and the kids are talking, and they won't stop talking, and they're still talking. And if you don't know anything about golf, it's like when you're swinging or about to swing, you don't talk. That you could talk all the rest of the time, but that time you just need to be quiet. And so anyways, I'm trying to focus, and, you know, they're running in front of me, and I'm like, no, get back there. You're going to get hit in the face. And, you know, just a really good time. And so anyways, I'm a little flustered, and I wind up, and I swing, thwack, right into the trees. Without missing a beat, my beloved child, Caleb, says, "Well, you're never going to see that ball again." You know, you just don't know how deep anger runs until you know. You know, children are a blessing from the Lord. What can I say? See, no one is excluded from the natural effects of anger. So when Jesus said that you're angry with someone, that you're subject to court, to going to court. But here's the thing, everyone gets angry. It's a natural, regular human emotion. And so if Jesus is saying, look, you can't be angry, he might as well just be saying, look, existing is a sin. But thankfully, that's not what Jesus is saying. We all know that we can be angry with someone, we can let it go, or we can choose to continue to be angry with that person, right? We all know that there is a difference between letting something go and stoking the fire of anger until it burns into a rage. And so when Jesus talks about being angry with someone, he's not talking about just the passing emotion of anger. He's talking about willfully choosing to be angry at another person. And we are held accountable to what we do when our anger comes. See, even if we don't fall into to road rage or throwing things, it doesn't mean that we're still innocent. Anger on the inside, even if it's not expressed outwardly, is still wrong. It's still dangerous. Because anger entertained breeds contempt. Anger breeds contempt. Jesus goes on to give us two examples of contempt. The first is calling someone an idiot, or raka, as some Bible translations will have it. And the second is outright cursing, or the biblical term is calling someone "you fool." Today, you could use a different F word, and it would have the same meaning. When you call someone an idiot or any word in that category, You are devaluing the other person. You are dehumanizing them. You are weighing their worth, and you're saying, you know what, you're less. You're less than me, for sure, and probably less than a bunch of other people as well. And to call someone you fool in the biblical sense, or the generic idea of cursing someone, is Jesus considered to be so devastating to the human soul, so emotionally taxing and causing so much emotional harm, that Jesus considered it a just punishment to send the offender to the smoldering garbage dump of human existence. Contempt dehumanizes people. It spits on our very need to belong. Anger and contempt are inherently poisonous to the human soul. You know, when you stop to think about it, how many problems in the world would cease to exist if we could control our anger? The crime rate would go way down. Passive aggressive comments and condescending glances would cease. A lot more marriages would stay intact. Children would thrive. How many wars would be avoided? Races undivided? But despite this, despite all of the negative the anger brings, our society seems to think that anger is justified or even necessary as a motivation for social change. But hating the other guy is not a solution. Hating the other guy is not a solution. Even though we treat politics that way, we often treat social justice that way, but it's not the Jesus way. I love what Dallas Willard writes. He says, "There is nothing that can be done with anger that cannot be done better without it." See, Jesus was smart enough to know that if we could deal with our anger problem, we would follow almost all of the law perfectly. Our laws don't need laws. We don't need another piece of legislation. We need a transformed heart. And so, having tackled the problem of anger in the heart, Jesus gives us two examples of the kingdom heart, of a heart that is transformed by the gospel. And that starts in verse 23. He says, "So if you're presenting a sacrifice at the altar of the temple, and you suddenly remember that someone has something against you, leave your sacrifice there at the altar. Go and be reconciled to that person. Then come and offer your sacrifice to God. When you're on your way to court with your adversary, settle your differences quickly. Otherwise, your accuser may hand you over to the judge, who will hand you over to an officer, and you will be thrown into prison. And if that happens, you surely won't be free again until you have paid the last penny." So Jesus gives us two examples of people who are transformed by the kingdom heart. The first is a person who's going to offer sacrifices at the temple, and while he's there, he remembers that someone is angry at him, and so he leaves to go and make it right. Now, this isn't just like showing up to church, okay? Sacrifices wasn't something you did every day or even every week. Think of it like you're going to church to be baptized. It's your baptism Sunday. It's Easter Sunday and you're on the band. I don't know, something like that. And you come and you remember that someone is mad at you. You're not mad at them. They're mad at you. And you are so moved. You are so moved by the burden of hatred that they are carrying that you just walk down the aisle and out the back door. That's what a kingdom transformed heart looks like. Right? Jesus isn't talking about do this literally. He's saying, think about the kind of person so transformed in their heart that they would do that. He goes on to give us another example. He talks about a court case, and you're going to court, and they've wronged you, and maybe you've wronged them, who knows, but you want to make the other person pay every last penny. They're going to get what is coming to them. But how do the people of the kingdom handle it? They try to settle it outside of court. They try to look at it objectively, as objectively as they can, and say, you know what, did I own any part of this? Is there maybe something that I do need to pay here? Is there any way that I have handled this situation poorly? See, instead of reacting in anger and lawyering up, you try to genuinely understand what the other person is going through. To pay what you owe instead of trying to stick it to them when you seek justice. You see, the irony that Jesus says is that if we try to get every last penny, we're going to have to pay every last penny. But the people of the kingdom don't retaliate. But they also don't roll over and play dead either. See, you need to understand that Jesus is saying, look, don't devalue other people. But he's also not saying devalue yourself. Because you matter too. But most important of all, the people of the kingdom, the children of God, recognize that the things of this world, our worldly possessions, we're not married to them. So what if we lose? It's not the end of the world, because that's not where our confidence lies. Now, at this moment, we're in a very great danger of doing the exact same thing that the scribes and the Pharisees did. In our legalistic bent, we may try to take Jesus' words and make them into a nice, neat list of laws. So instead of just don't murder someone, it's like, okay, don't harbor anger. Don't call people idiots. Okay, I can do that. Don't curse at your fellow human. Don't worship if someone is angry at you, and settle lawsuits outside of court. If we just follow these five keys to the kingdom heart, we'll surpass the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. No, that's not how it works. Don't miss the point. You cannot legislate morality in our hearts. Burdening people with more laws will just cause more despair, more self-righteousness, and more loopholes to be a terrible person while doing good things. When we make these to be laws, we cut ourselves off at the knees. Think about it this way. This summer, my family and I are going camping in Revelstoke. Now, if you want to know how to get to Revelstoke, you pull out your phone, right? You open your maps, and then you Google California. And then you're like, okay, that's one way not to get there. And then you type in London. You're like, okay, now I know two ways not to get there. But here's the thing. Not going to London or California is a very poor plan for going to Revelstoke. In the same way, not hating people is a terrible plan for loving people. And that is what Jesus is driving at. Love is the higher law. And Paul expounds on this in Galatians 3:21. He says, if the law could give us new life, we could be made right by God by just obeying it. And again, in Romans 13:8, he says, if you love your neighbor, you will fulfill the requirements of God's law. Love fulfills the law. Really. Right, how often do we say love fulfills the law and then we just kind of roll on? No, love fulfills the law. Really. See, if we genuinely love people, not only will we not murder them, but we won't hate them. We won't be contemptuous towards them. The law properly understood leads to love. See, the righteousness that surpasses the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees is a heart that is transformed by Christ. Nothing else will do. Jesus closes his section on righteousness in verse 48. And he says this, he says, but you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. That's a lot more intense than just don't murder. And to follow the law as Jesus represents it, to be perfect, that is soul-crushing. That is difficult. That is impossible. How can you be perfect like Jesus is perfect? How can you be perfect like the Father is perfect? No one can love like that except for the Son of God himself. Exactly. See, Jesus does not just give us an example to follow. Jesus does not just teach us the true meaning of the law. Jesus is the way. He fulfills the law. He is the embodiment of the law. I love what Richard Lovelace writes, he says, we are not saved by the love that we exercise, but by the love that we trust. The love that we trust. Love really is the higher law, but it's not my love. It's not your love. It's not our understanding of love or how we've taught to love or how the world thinks we should love. It's Christ's love at work in us and through us. Only then can we begin to love our neighbor. Only then can we be perfect as our Heavenly Father is perfect. You see, to be perfect is both who we are in Christ, but it's also how we strive to live as broken people welcomed into the kingdom of heaven. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you. I thank you that you sent Jesus to fulfill the law, to teach us that love is the higher law, but not our own love. His love, love incarnate. And so Jesus, once again, having examined our hearts and seeing that, you know what, there's a little bit more anger in there than I would like, I thank you that we don't have to feel guilty, we don't have to be in condemnation, because you have made us perfect. But we still got a long way to go. And I pray that as we leave this place, as we sing this last song, that we would leave with a resolve to be perfect as our Father in heaven is perfect.